Veni, veni, venias, and welcome to our podcast. Good evening, and welcome to Ask a Medievalist. I'm Em, the Ask portion of our program, and joining me tonight, as always, is Dr. Jesse Noose.
Hello!
So, we started this series as a way to answer the question, did people in the Middle Ages bathe? And actually, we've also talked about toothbrushing, public baths, and plumbing. But specifically, last time we talked about plumbing from the ancient Indus Valley civilization through to Rome. So that only really brings us to the beginning of the Middle Ages.
Right.
So today, we're going to start with talking about plumbing in the Middle Ages.
Yes. The fun part about this, of course, is that plumbing, starting from sort of the time of the Romans and moving on into what we call the current era, so the past 2,000 years of plumbing, plumbing kind of disappears out of Western Europe, which, of course...
What a pity.
...is one of those funny things about Europe. Yes. Plumbing sticks around places where the Romans had created it.
Okay. So,
or the Etruscans, of course, as we discussed. Really, the Etruscans came up with plumbing and then the Romans improved upon it. Or continued it.
So does that mean that places like Rome had running water and, like, flush toilets? Or just sort of, like, the fountains and stuff?
But the fountains, running water.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, baths.
Okay.
Public and otherwise continued, to flush your toilets, you still had to, like, throw water down there.
Right.
You know, to flush it out into the sewers and stuff. But all of that still existed. And like I said, continues to exist.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So they kept going with it. Places where it was and it continued to work continued to have it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's true across Europe as well, actually. So, you know, places where the Romans had built plumbing frequently continued to use it. Not always, though.
Mm-hmm.
Because... You know, one of the things that happened when the Romans, like, sort of packed up and left, famously. And in this case, we're talking sort of far Western Europe, because obviously Italy is Western Europe, but far Western Europe. So places where the Romans had been, like England and France. Those areas, some places continue to use their Roman plumbing, whatever had it. But a lot of places really it kind of disappeared.
Okay.
And a lot of this has to do with, I mean, this is why, of course, and this isn't specifically why, but this is one of the reasons why people start calling it the Dark Ages, right? That's unfair.
lack of indoor plumbing.
Yes. This is unfair.
I mean, it is like camping, right? Which is pretty... Yeah. I'm not going to say anything. I don't want to get emails from angry camping fans, but, like...
I mean, camping works great for camping.
Yeah.
But, you know, when you're in a city, living
not so
with
great.
People...
Yeah.
Right. That's when it starts to become problematic. This is also why all those stereotypes about medieval cleanliness persist. Because, they didn't have the plumbing capabilities that Rome did.
Yeah.
And that previous, as we talked about, like, lots of previous amazing civilizations had, right? So, the Minoans, Indus Valley, you know, so going all the way back, I mean, there's a lot of amazing ancient plumbing.
Right.
And the funny aspect of plumbing having sort of not exactly bypassed Europe, because, again, the Etruscans, the Romans, of course, did it, and the Minoans, and so on. But it did sort of disappear, right? And so, yes, what are you doing with sewage? And so this really becomes the cornerstone of all of those stereotypes that we sort of started this series to try to disprove.
This is where we get the Terry Pratchett joke about the river that runs through Ankh-Morpork that you can't drown in it, but you might suffocate because it's so full of the various waste products of civilization, let's say.
Yes. Yes. And, I mean, far be it from us to pretend that we don't do terrible things to our water, which we have also talked about, and rivers as well. Of course, we are horrible with lots of things. I mean, this is why we have to keep clearing up, you know, oil spills and all the rest of it in our oceans. Right. And in Cleveland, right? Isn't it Cleveland? The Cuyahoga River?
Is that the one that caught on fire? Yeah.
Yeah. I think a lot. Like, it kept catching. And they finally had to... I mean, they finally cleaned it up.
Yeah.
But it was this sort of horrific, you know. So, and that's, of course, modern pollution, which we've also talked about, right? So modern pollution of oils and chemicals. This is what Enemy of the People is about, Ibsen's play. Right. And today, you know, it continues on, of course. We've Flint and Michigan in general and many other places as well.
Right.
Reservations, right? It's one of the sort of things about, you know, land that Native Americans have been allowed to keep or have maintained, managed to keep, that, you know, not having running water or plumbing, but wanting to build pipelines for oil across it, which is the opposite of, you know. Anyway, so, so it's not like we are in any way immune or better exactly, right? I think that is a very important thing to remember. I believe actually recently the Chicago River, a certain building that is on the Chicago River that is named for a certain former president who puts his name on buildings, just got cited a while ago. It turned out for like a couple years it was like dumping stuff into the river. Totally illegally. And they finally got caught.
Shocked.
Yeah.
No, okay, so here's the thing, right? Like, when you have a lot of human waste being dumped into rivers and stuff, you get typhoid.
Yes.
And other,
among other things. Yeah.
Yeah, a lot of really bad, like, so you get, or cholera, right? Like, you get these epidemics.
Yes.
And famously. This happens, I mean, even through to the end of the 19th century, like, the British thought that cholera was an airborne disease in the, in when there were outbreaks in British India that killed a lot
of
people.
But that's where the sewer system comes from,
Right. So, like, nowadays we have chemicals in the water, and they definitely cause you to die, but they do it a little bit more slowly, I think. Like, a lot of them will give you cancer if you drink the water for 40 years. But, you know, it's a different type of bad, maybe.
Right.
I'm not sure. Well, I'm not sure that's the world's most compelling argument. Like, you die a little bit more slowly. But okay.
Well, but also, but there are plenty of places to this day where there is waste in the rivers, same way, and you do get cholera and all that stuff. I mean, there are plenty of places in the world that haven't been sort of allowed to develop plumbing and sewers in this way.
Right.
Right. So this is just always the reminder, right, that yes, we sort of look down upon this, but really it isn't just
it's our problem too.
It's our problem too, yes. Yes.
Yeah.
So but anyway, so for example, yes, London famously, yes, the idea that we're actually going to talk about this because we're going to end this section with perfumes. The whole point of perfumes, this is actually because this goes along with sort of what happens at the end. We talked about soaps before and brushing your teeth and sort of things smelling nice and people wanted to smell good. And obviously perfumes were a final part of that. So they didn't have like bath bombs at the time, but they definitely had this idea that, you know, after you'd bathe and whatever, you wanted to smell good. So you put on perfumes, you perfumed your clothes, you, you know, perfumed stuff. But also there was the idea that good smells were healthy and that bad smells were what made you sick.
Okay.
Right? Contagion. That was where contagion sort of came from. It's interesting because, of course, that's not exactly how contagion worked, but things can be airborne. So they were right that things can be airborne. The problem is that bad smells aren't necessarily what tell you something's
right.
Like, that's not necessarily how you get airborne diseases. That's not how you get airborne diseases. But of course, if you do get rid of a terrible smell, it might also get rid of the cause of the disease, mm-hmm. which is what happened. So that is why London built their sort of initial sewers were specifically because the point was to get rid of the smell,
mm-hmm.
right? And so it took all the waste away, which is what sewers do. Of course, it wasn't actually the smell. It was the stuff that was in the water.
Yes.
But it comes to the same thing, I guess, is the point. So the outbreaks did stop.
QED.
But...
Ta-da! Yes. That's science right there.
Right. Although they did finally prove that it had, in fact, stopped because of the actual mm-hmm. stuff that was taken away, of course, and not because of the smell. Because, there's the famous thing that, I don't know if it's a sort of true-ish story, right? That there was, like, a rotten eel in a pump, and there's another pump where there wasn't one, and they sort of proved that the outbreak had happened around the one with the rotten eel, or whatever it was. And that's really how they do clusters today, where they figure out where an outbreak of a disease is.
Oh, was that, Jon Snow, I believe.
Yeah.
Who proved that the one woman... who was in a different part of town, got the disease because she was having the water from the other pump brought to her.
Yes.
And so he was like, it's definitely the pump.
Yeah. He still didn't quite know how it was transmitted. He didn't get to germ theory.
Mm-hmm.
But he did create the dot map to illustrate the cluster of cases around the pump.
Yes.
And that is how... That is still how these things are done. So what, wasn't it Haiti? They finally proved that the UN was responsible for an outbreak.
Oh, yeah.
And the same thing, right? They did the same cluster sort of dot map that Snow did back in the day.
Yep.
I'm sure
we've seen, like...
Florence Nightingale created some incredible medical maps and really...
Anyway. Yeah. No, I mean, like, we've seen those from COVID outbreaks, too. Like...
Yes. Oh, God. Yeah, of course. Yeah, yeah. Yep.
It's good to know.
But, yes. So, but this is where they come from. Brilliantly. So London's, that's sort of where London sewers come from.
Mm-hmm.
Chicago also had some really great early sewer systems. But yeah, this sort of interesting sense that initially it was the idea of the smell. So this is the thing, though, right? That the Middle Ages, as much as we sort of think of it, right, most people didn't live in significant population clusters
mm-hmm.
where the smell was going to bother you the way we sort of imagine, right? Only somewhere like London, where you do have who knows how many people squished in together.
Yes.
Throwing their waste out into the street. Yes, in those instances, of course, it's going to become a problem.
I know it was up sort to of, like... Hmm? It was about 5 million at the end of the 19th century, but
yes.
I don't know what it was at the end of the Middle Ages. But
I will also point out, of course, that the worst of it happens after the Middle Ages, right?
Yeah.
The Middle Ages end around 1500,
mm-hmm.
right? And the worst sort of period for London, and certainly for health and for sewage and all the rest of it, is really like the 1700s and 1800s. That's when you have tremendous amounts of people, you don't really have plumbing... And you have the Industrial Revolution. So you have all of the things going on at once.
Oh, God. Yeah. I mean...
And that's what really... that's what really knocks it out. But also, I think that is one of the places a lot of these stereotypes come from, mm-hmm. actually. Is people... Like, the memory of what it was sort of like in Victorian England and of those cholera outbreaks and stuff like that... there was that somehow, like, people take that and think, well, if that's how bad it was recently, it must have been however worse, right, in the Middle Ages. And that's not actually necessarily true, mm-hmm. right? It was not worse in the Middle Ages. It was worse in Victorian London.
The Victorians were just,
you know,
brutal.
Yes, in many ways.
Yeah, I mean, like...
I mean, they did some amazing things.
Yeah.
They did eventually build sewers. But, yeah, it was tough.
As much as I love the late 19th century, oh my God. Like,
I mean, there's a reason that Dickensian is the adjective that it is.
Yes.
Dickens recorded it very brilliantly.
Mm-hmm.
And it's terrible.
Yeah.
I mean, it's brutal. It is brutal. It is terrible.
I also weirdly recommend the book From Hell by Alan Moore.
I guess it's a graphic novel. Well, yes. But, yes. Jack the Ripper.
Yeah.
So many things. I mean, that gave us... It's not that serial killers hadn't existed before, but no, they hadn't been considered in that way before.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yes, Victorian London gave us so much. But I do want to back it up a little bit. So one of the things we're actually talking about, interestingly, plumbing, of course, and irrigation go hand in hand. And we didn't really talk about irrigation, mm-hmm. because, of course, that farming and agriculture, that's a whole other thing. But I do want to bring up... China. We didn't talk, I think, really about China yet. China absolutely develops plumbing and irrigation, and sort of around the same time Rome is doing it, and then into the, you know, modern era.
This is not surprising. China was amazing. They did everything.
Oh, yeah. I mean, as we know, right? They invented the printing press and all these things.
Yeah.
And, you know, movable gunpowder.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. So they invented a lot of stuff that makes it to Europe. The funny thing about this, of course, is that they... really start in on sort of plumbing and irrigation in a big way in Sichuan, the irrigating the Chengdu Plain.
Mm-hmm.
They get into this in a big way around the same time really the Romans are doing it. And so the 3rd century BCE is when they really start. And it's this irrigation project. And they divert some of the waters of the main river running through the plain to keep it from flooding.
Mm-hmm.
And they build kind of a levee and then channels to divert the water. And then, of course, once you've done that, you can, you know, you start doing whatever you want with the water. So you get aqueducts to bring it to people's houses and to irrigate the farmland and all this stuff. And so it becomes this incredible farmland. And it lasts up through 1933. There's an earthquake. And some of it has to be restored.
Hmm.
But it's a UNESCO heritage site and it is still in use.
Okay.
So that's more than 2,000 years that those aqueducts and channels and stuff have been in use. They're still in use. So that's China. In the Americas. Now, this is really the fun part because the best example of plumbing from the real Middle Ages is, in fact, in the Americas, which tend to get left off the Middle Ages chart.
Ooh, which is unfair. Is it Tenochtitlan?
They have irrigation.
Okay.
But the full-on, like, plumbing that we're thinking of that goes to people's houses is really Incan.
Ah, okay.
Yeah. The Aztecs do it, yes. They also, but the large-scale plumbing is Incan. And what makes it so impressive, you know, because the Aztecs, yes, they have irrigation, they have the channels, very similar to China. But what makes the Incan plumbing so exciting is that they're, of course, up in the mountains.
Oh, yeah.
They're in the Andes, right? And they are diverting water from springs and stuff throughout the mountains. And they are doing really what the Romans are doing.
Oh.
Very similar, with aqueducts, right? So they have graded channels.
Mm-hmm.
just for an example. So the Inca, of course, really get going in the mid-1400s and last through the end of the 1500s, mid-end of 1500s, when, of course, Spanish colonialism ruins everything. But
yes.
Famous examples are places like Machu Picchu, which is at 8,000 feet.
Mm-hmm.
which is very impressive, right? So this is the sort of this amazing thing, right? That the city is located by natural springs, which is clearly sort of the point. So
right.
The initial kind of royal residence was built closest to the springs, so it'd be the easiest to sort of divert water. But so the northern slope of the mountain, ancient Incan engineers, and really medieval, of course, is what we're talking about, engineers created basically the sort of aqueduct plumbing system that does also remain functional today when it, you know, you can go take pictures of water running out of stuff today because the springs continue to work, and when it rains, you know, some stuff happens. So same as we said last time, like with the Minoans and stuff. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it all still works. So there's a canal that carries water from the first spring to the city center.
Okay.
It's 749 meters long and varies in width between like 10 and 12 centimeters.
So that's about stone-lined. Half a foot in diameter, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, that's a good pipe.
Yeah, that's pretty decent.
Pipe size, right?
I have no idea what, like, your average underground pipe today is, but that seems, you know.
I mean, ones that sort of go to and from houses, I think, aren't that much, or the ones that go around your house are about this size, I think.
I think so.
Yeah. So
they're doing some they're doing work on the next street over, so I'll go over there and spy on them.
Take a look. See. Yes.
Yeah.
So it slopes, the slope of the canal is about 3%. So that's the grade, right? So gravity, you know, runs it down to the city center. The canal first enters the agricultural sector of the city. So the first thing it does is irrigate the crops and stuff, and then it goes into the urban center where it flows through a system of fountains. This is why I said they really set up things the same as the Romans did, right? Because fountains are how you divert water into certain sections of the city, and then people can come use the fountains, right? So there are 16 fountains throughout Machu Picchu. The first one was at the ruler's residence, right? So that would have been the I mean, you have first access, basically. Yeah. It comes to you first.
Hook the boss
if anything's going to dry up. Yes. If anything's going to dry up, you're still going to get your water.
Yeah.
So then, and then they built in a lot of interesting things. So like the third fountain can be bypassed using a buried channel that can just carry water directly from fountain two to fountain four. So I guess if there's not enough water, right, you can skip the fountain three. Starting at fountain four, the water flows in a series of different channels, then, you know, on its way eventually to fountain 16, and then is discharged. Mm-hmm. And it forms this sort of stairway of fountains.
Wow.
So it's, you know, it's a cool architectural thing. Who doesn't love, you know, little fountain waterfalls and stuff, right? But it's also a very specific way to get water around the city. So at the top of each fountain, you have a specific spout that was built to fill ink and water jugs, basically. So there was the right size, you know, to fill an ink and water jug. And they all had, all the fountains then had drained, so it would drain back out and continue to the next fountain, right? If you weren't, people weren't filling their jugs.
Okay.
Yeah. And this is sort of the point, ultimately, right? That you're making sure that the water gets to people who need it, but then that's the point of plumbing. Things drain out and continue on based on, you know, like a water fountain today. It's, they all have to have, you have to have a drain. The water goes out, gets filtered, goes somewhere else, right? So there is a river down below for a secondary water source if necessary. But the infrastructure of the plumbing is designed to make sure that the domestic water supply of Machu Picchu is pure, right? So agricultural runoff and stormwater discharges away from the main water canals.
That's clever.
Yes. So drainage, they were very aware of drainage, particularly because you're on the side of a mountain, right? So like mudslides and stuff are, you know, if there's extreme rain, as we know. So the way that, so this is another thing about how they built the fountains, how they diverted the water. The drainage is really important. So they're really, they really concentrate on the drainage, not just from actual drains, but also what they sort of put in some of the channels. So you have sort of layers, right, of like stones and gravel and sand and topsoil, so that the land around kind of the fountains and the channels also helps with the drainage. And then there are drainage holes in a lot of areas of the city so that water drains into sort of stairways, walkways, you know, buildings had kind of, again, like eaves and stuff that would carry stuff to the main drains, things like that. I guess that's not what our eaves do, really, but sort of do.
Can, I mean, you know.
That's what they do.
We have like a French drain in our yard, so like all the, what do you call it? The gutters are sort of set up to bring the water mm-hmm. to that.
Yep. So. Yeah. Yes. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so the point was to make sure that any sort of water that might not be pure is kept out of kind of the domestic water supply.
Mm-hmm.
So great extensive drainage system, which is apparently one of the reasons why it still works, actually. Oh. Because it was so well done that, you know,
everybody.
I mean, that's why Rome still works, basically. Yeah. When you have the right drainage system, then your plumbing isn't overloaded.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, it's fine, basically. I gotta say, Richmond needs better drains.
Mm-hmm.
Gonna put that out there. Anyway, so, but yeah, so the Inca had, you know, yeah, they really worked at it. They had great drainage.
All the Richmond city councilors are gonna be like, oh no.
I know.
We better get on that.
I mean, it's weird because when it rains, there are certain areas that just flood automatically.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure that it's because, you know, we talked last time also about a lot of ancient plumbing systems, obviously also the Inca, great drains, but a lot of ancient plumbing systems also had a lot of, like, access points so yeah. that you would go out and clean your sewers, right?
Mm-hmm.
I feel like that is a thing that modern sewer management maybe needs more of. At least around here.
Mm-hmm.
I think, because also, I mean, the streets that flood a lot tend to be by the river, and they're probably silted up with stuff. I mean, I don't know.
Sure.
But, yes. Anyway. Issues.
All right.
Many issues. But yeah, so the Aztecs, so speaking of the Aztecs, though, yes, they did absolutely have great irrigation and things. The Aztecs did absolutely build their own aqueducts. The Spanish then came in and sort of rebuilt them and built their own.
All right.
Which is funny because, of course, it's not like Spain had better. I mean, they also had Roman stuff. Mm-hmm. It's not like they had better plumbing or anything. but there are some very famous examples that are still around.
But notably, the Aztec, like Tenochtitlan, was kind of in the middle of a swamp. So their water management issues were probably significantly different than what you're dealing with if you're living in, you know, Machu Picchu, something like that.
Yes. Yeah, and that's the point, that they're very, it's very much about irrigation,
mm-hmm.
which was really famous, though. I mean, and the Spanish were actually really overawed when they saw it.
Probably they should be.
Yes, at just how extraordinary sort of the canals were. I mean, the way they described it always makes it sound a little bit like Venice.
Mm-hmm.
Except that, of course, Venice... Well, no. I mean, not except anything. It's basically a little bit like Venice.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. They're in the middle of, like, this lake swamp. And they've just built all these channels and stuff
mm-hmm.
around everything. Yeah. Canals. And the Spanish were just really amazed. As they should be. Yeah.
Yeah.
They didn't have anything like it. So, you know,
it's funny also, how many cities are like the Venice of the blank, just like,
right.
Austin is the Madison of the South. So Tenochtitlan yes. is the Venice of the Americas, I guess.
Yes. 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 And that's maybe not unfair because I think Venice is older maybe, but,
mm-hmm.
But it could probably just as easily have been the other way around. Yeah. Cause Tenochtitlan probably had more people.
Mm-hmm.
Not sure about that. It had more people than any Spanish city, at least. So yeah, there's definitely a a sort of interesting sensibility of the But again, and of course, fountains and everything. Yes, so they similarly had sort of the irrigation, the aqueducts, all of these things. Yeah, so it is interesting because ancient cities, and again, here we are in the Americas. So this is medieval. This is where real medieval plumbing happens, is in the Americas. Yeah, with the Inca, the Aztecs. And it's this weird, reminder of just how kind of not advanced Europe was at the time, right?
Yeah.
So, like, Cortez, realizing how important the aqueduct was, and I think there was an aqueduct he ultimately destroyed, as you know, to sort of force his conquering of the city, because he realized just how important it was. It was this thing that, like, brought fresh water to the city. And obviously, if you can mess with the water supply, that's brilliant. But it is this also, like, reminder that this is something that, of course, right, the Spanish came in, they found this incredible thing with this incredible engineering, both for the Aztecs and for the Inca, right? And then they destroyed it all.
Yeah. Welcome to colonialism.
Which is really horrible and is not part of the story and really, really should be. Obviously, genocide is much worse than destroying aqueducts. But the problem with destroying things like aqueducts, right? Mm-hmm. And actually, it's worth pointing out that one of the theories for a while had been for Machu Picchu that they'd had to abandon it because they didn't have enough water. And pretty much the engineering around the aqueducts has demonstrated that wasn't true.
I see.
Which is why, actually, I wanted to bring up the Inca specifically. Because that does not seem to have been true at all. They absolutely knew how to do their water. So, and the thing is, right, again, it's this reminder of Europe comes in, the Spanish, really.
Mm-hmm.
Mostly the Spanish. The Portuguese, a little bit, but mostly the Spanish. And destroy everything. And then we get this narrative somehow that they came in and subdued a civilization, or civilizations, right? The Aztec, the Inca, the Mayans, that were not as sophisticated,
mm-hmm.
right? And of course, that's all pseudoscience anyway, the whole discussion of, like, what is a sophisticated civilization. But that is the narrative, right?
Yeah.
That the Americas did not have the things that Europe had, and this is why they were subdued. And in many, I mean, of course, things were very different, but there were a lot of incredible engineering feats and technologies mm-hmm. that the Americas did have that Europe did not have anymore. Or if they did have them, they had them because, for example, the Romans had left them behind and they still worked.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't have them because medieval Europe had built them.
Right.
Right. And so this, It's a really important reminder. Like, so medieval plumbing is happening in the Americas. It's not happening in Europe.
Yes.
And the fact that the Spanish come in and destroy it, then people sort of can forget to what extent it was happening in the Americas. Right? And it's become a little bit more of a thing, right? Tenochtitlan has become known as having been this amazing city. But I think people don't still fully realize just what it mm-hmm. was. Right? It would be as if, you know, I don't want to insult anyone here, but, like, what's a city that is kind of, I don't know, we would think of as being, as having, like, I don't know, nothing there.
Oh, like Des Moines?
Ah! Yes, it would be as if people from Des Moines, like, destroyed Chicago and New York. Right? And then started building skyscrapers later that were like 10, 15 stories.
Mm-hmm.
And being like, look at us.
Okay.
We did this amazing thing. Right?
Okay.
Now, to be fair, I'm sure Des Moines has buildings that are like 100 stories. But, you know, yes, it's that kind of thing.
I don't know if they allow that in Iowa.
I know.
Sorry.
Well, but
sorry, Iowa.
Know. I know. We do like Iowa. We apologize, Iowa.
Eh.
But it's that kind of thing, right? That you come in and then you're like, aha, look, we did this thing. But you did not do this thing. The people before you did it much better. And you didn't have it until you came in and saw it.
Yeah.
Or you were like, oh, look, they did what the Romans did. We can rebuild that here.
Yeah.
After we just destroyed what they did. We'll rebuild another one, and we know how to do that because we have one at home that is also like 2,000 years old that the Romans built.
Yeah.
Right? But they themselves were not building them or doing this type of thing at the time. Yeah. So that's the shout-out to the Incans, the Aztecs, for having had the medieval plumbing that Europe didn't. That being said, again, I don't want to... That shouldn't make you think Europe was smelly, but it is a reminder. It's an important reminder. This does take us then to what was Europe doing?
I'd say, let's believe that Europe was potentially needlessly cruel, let's say, not smelly, just
right.
Bad neighbors.
Yes, well, yeah, exactly. So yes, what was it that they were doing mm-hmm. when they didn't have access to Roman plumbing or Etruscan plumbing. Or Minoan plumbing, right, for that matter, depending on where you are. Okay. if you're rich, you may, last time we talked all about, even this time a little bit, mm-hmm. with, of course, Dinkins, for example, how the rich got plumbing. If anyone had plumbing, you had plumbing, and probably a private bath, and things like this. Well, not so much. So, yeah, medieval Europe, this is not a thing. Nobody really has plumbing.
Mm-hmm.
Again, unless you're living somewhere that the Romans had built it. But if you're not, nobody really has plumbing. So
no worries.
Right. So this is why we had said a lot of bathing in, like, rivers and lakes, mm-hmm. and a lot of drownings, unfortunately, because you're bathing in running water.
Yes.
And you never know. So you're clean, but it is more dangerous than, like, a public bath.
Clean, right? And dead.
Yes. But, yeah. Which is unfortunate. But, so we should give a shout out to castles, which, as we know them, or as we think of them, right, medieval castles, they are built starting around, like, the 1000s,
mm-hmm.
basically. So 1100s is when we start to get the castles that we think of as medieval castles.
The sort of and large we're already gothic structures, because this yes. is also when we start to see, you know, large gothic structures like Notre Dame.
Exactly.
And other...
Yes, cathedrals.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yes, so we are also, monasteries, of course, we are also, therefore, we're halfway through the Middle Ages at this point as well, right? So the yes. early Middle Ages, not so much castles. But what you get in castles, in wealthy houses and stuff,
mm-hmm.
Generally speaking, the toilet would, there are two possibilities. One is that it would have a shaft in the outer wall.
Okay.
So the toilet would basically be against the outer wall, but not quite. And there's a shaft that's, like, built into the outer wall. And waste would just drop down into possibly a moat or a river. Or even, like, the ocean, if you're next to the ocean, I guess.
Okay.
But anyway, body of water. if possible, body of water. But otherwise, like, a moat. Most moats did not have water. But they would be filled with, like, refuse and stuff.
Because
mm-hmm. it was a way to discourage... You know,
sure.
People.
I mean, I just changed my invasion plans knowing that.
Yes. So, yeah. So, waste also would drop down. Sometimes it's just actually a hole. Like, sometimes it's not a shaft that goes all the way down the wall.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes it only goes partway down the hall and then stops. And then, like, the rest of the wall. Because you don't want people to be able to crawl into the castle up it or anything.
Right.
You know, you'd sit on sort of the stone toilet seat. It was usually covered with, like, a wooden bench
mm-hmm.
To make it, I guess, warmer, more comfortable. I don't know. There's some stories about, like, the wooden bench, in some cases where, like, it's a really big opening and there would be a wooden bench that would be over it, like, with several holes that people could sit in. There's stories about sometimes it, like, being rotten and giving way and people falling in.
Eek.
Or falling below. Yeah.
Oh, dear.
Some of these stories are probably true. Who is to say? Mm. Anyway. Some of them, maybe... not, who knows. But anyway, so if you did not live in a place, if you were rich enough to be able to sort of build in your toilet in this way, because as we talked last time about how you know chamber pots, of course, were a thing, that,
right.
that was basically it. But if you could build a house where you could sort of have this opening, that's great. You wanted it to be somewhere where there are windows, because otherwise, obviously, smell. If you didn't have access to that kind of, you know, to something like a moat or a river or something that would clean it up for you, then you had to hire someone who would clean it out. I mean, basically, then it's...
Oh, dear. Yeah.
Like a, you know, today.
Mm-hmm.
Like a porta potty.
Right.
Right. And someone would have to come in and clean out the cesspool, basically, at the bottom, occasionally. And the job for this... This is fun. Okay, so
okay.
It was known as, we today call it, you know, the toilet or the bathroom. It could also be called the privy or the latrine.
Mm-hmm.
The water closet, of course. It was formerly known as the gong. So that's G-O-N-G.
Okay.
Like the thing that you hit that makes sound.
Okay.
The word seems to come from, and by the way, gong, meaning latrine, does appear in Old English. So it's an old term. And so that, you know, Old English. So it keeps being used, but before even the 1000s, we're thinking, right? So it's probably older even than the 1000s. So that's gong. So in English, Old English, it seems to come from the word gang, G-A-N-G, gang, which meant, you know, it's from the word, like, going, go,
gang,
which is why, like, a gangway, right? It's a path that you walk down, right? Gangway. So a gang meant walkway, course, passage, passageway, gangway. Mm-hmm. Also walking, journeying, going. So a gong, it's not clear if it's because, like, is it the passage, like, waste falls down this passage? Mm-hmm. Is that the gong? Is that clear? We can still sometimes discuss going to the bathroom as, like, the go.
Sure.
But I don't know that that's actually related to where the word gong, to why the word gong was used.
I also question if anybody outside of, like, commercials for toilet paper says that.
Probably not, but it's an interesting, it's really interesting because it might or might not be related to one of the oldest terms that we actually no longer use for toilet.
There was journal of rude language called, I think it was called Maledict or Malediction.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Uh-huh. So I wonder if they've done any research on this.
Hopefully. That'd be fun. But anyway, yeah. So gong farmers cleaned out privies, right?
Okay.
The gong is the, right. So gong farmers cleaned out privies. So that's what they were. Gong farmers. The word is attested in English. I mean, this is English. We're talking about English. But as early as 1302, says the OED.
Okay.
That's in print. So obviously it was in use in the 1200s.
So, like, we say print, like, this is, in 1302, this is handwritten.
It's not
stuff,
technically print.
Right, like, people.
Yes.
So, like.
It is.
We're getting into the increasingly unlikely that people would have written this down time period, I guess. Unless you have somebody's journal, right, where he's like, the gong farmers came today.
Right. So that's why the fact that it's attested in writing by 1302 means it's definitely in use in the 1200s.
So,
because, by the time,
It strikes me that the more, I want to say, like, the more euphemistic something is, like, the more embarrassed people are to maybe talk about it, the less likely you're going to find it attested at the beginning of its usage. I don't know.
Right. Yeah, yeah. Well, and gong, as we said, has been around since Old English.
Yeah.
So, you know, gong farmer, when did that come in? Well, don't know exactly, but definitely by the 1200s, yeah.
Actually quite a delightful little euphemism. I think we've talked before about a QI bit where Stephen Fry alleges that there are no words for a toilet in English that are not actually euphemisms.
Right.
Which is interesting.
He also, there's a section of QI where they talk about the night soil men, which is ultimately what happened. The reason that night soil becomes the new term is, of course, gong eventually goes away. It actually doesn't fully go away. The OED cites the usage of gong, meaning privy. Mm-hmm. Even, like, up in, like, the 2011, I think, there's a reference.
What?
So it doesn't, it doesn't fully go away. I assume that some of these references are based on people who did their research into the Middle Ages.
Right.
But it doesn't fully go away. It's also possible that if you're actually in England, there's a longer memory for what it means.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Here we are in the Americas. I don't know that it was ever really used in the Americas.
Right.
Right. So.
We did not have castles, for example.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, so it's possible that it was not really used here ever, and therefore we don't have that memory.
Mm-hmm.
But in England, maybe they have more of a memory. But gong farmers did only work at night. That's actually the point. Because, you know, it's nasty, dirty, smelly. So you come and clean out the cesspools, and at night you put it into your wheelbarrow, wheel it away to wherever you're taking it. You know, and you might be selling it as fertilizer and stuff, who knows, but basically then the fact that they worked at night is what took over.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So then they became known as night soil men, which of course, because they worked at night, and so the idea of night soil, which again, of course, is a euphemism, obviously.
And also a term that is still in use.
Yes, that's a term that we still use, even though we definitely, plumbers don't come out at night anymore.
No, not unless something is very wrong.
Yes, a real shame. But yes, so traditionally you had to work at night. You did get well paid per like pound of stuff, whatever, you know, but pound of night soil. But yeah, it was sort of like being an executioner, right? It was one of those jobs. And even, you know, sort of like garbage person today, I guess. One of those jobs where you get paid really well, but also kind of people don't want to know what you do, and they stay away from you.
This is also parodied in Terry Pratchett, I believe. There's a character.
Yes, yes, 100%.
Harry King, I think?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Yeah. And he's the night soil man, and he, you know, makes all of his money doing stuff that nobody else wants to do.
Yes, and he's super rich because everybody needs it. Because I think, as we said before, like urine is actually used in cleaning,
like ammonia, canning, right? It's canning leather. Yeah.
Yes. So, anyone who's willing to go through all that can make a lot of money, but you are kind of ostracized. And yeah, Harry King in Terry Pratchett, he lives sort of outside of town, and he employs generally people who can't be employed anywhere else, who can't get jobs anywhere else. As the books wear on, that turns out to be goblins. You know.
Yeah.
He employs goblins. Yeah. But yeah, absolutely. So that's where we get night soil, the fact that they worked at night, originally known as gong farmers. But that's basically what happens. And so that is how, through the Victorian period, that is how Europe mostly deals with plumbing, is just by having outhouses or something, or sometimes not quite an outhouse, something in your house so you don't actually have to go outside, but it still will take it to a cesspool, and you have somebody come and clean it out.
Yeah.
And that's what they did. So, yes, it's a really, I don't know, important reminder that the Middle Ages didn't have the plumbing, but really it's Europe didn't have the plumbing. The Americas definitely did. Right? They had, so, and plumbing has existed actually for thousands and thousands of years, right? The Indus Valley civilization is about as old as you get. So it's not like plumbing didn't exist. It's not like people couldn't have it. It's just that Europe didn't for a while. And of course, again, if you lived somewhere where the Romans and the Etruscans had built plumbing, you might still have had it because it still worked.
Right.
So Rome, for example. Parts of Rome. I mean, the drainage, all that stuff still worked.
But largely, a lot of Europe was kind of like, whatever.
Yes. Yes.
Which is kind of funny.
Yeah.
I mean, they lived. I mean...
Yeah, yeah.
In theory, those are a lot of our ancestors, right? Well,
yeah,
not yours, but some,
right?
Maybe people move
around.
Well,
some
lot.
Of them,
yeah.
But the funny thing is, we talked about like Japan and its hot springs and stuff, yeah. But yeah, I mean, it's one of those weird, weird things that. I don't know. I guess it seems like plumbing should be a modern invention. I don't know why. I mean, it's just pipes. Like, pipes aren't that... It's still just pipes.
Mm-hmm.
Like, granted, plastic, sure. But obviously, we all know that pipes used to be made out of other things, like terracotta and lead.
Yeah.
So why should we think it's so difficult to imagine that people would have... The really interesting thing I have to say, actually, which is one of the reasons why to bring up China and the Inca again, I forgot to mention this before, is because both places, so for China, right, the Sichuan, and also the Inca in the mountains, both of them had to occasionally blast through rock, which of course is something China did it before they'd invented gunpowder. So,
okay.
Yeah.
How did they do that?
Yes, exactly. And the Inca as well. It turns out that obviously, one of the ways you tunnel through things for plumbing today is with, like, dynamite and stuff. That's how you get rid of rock. Well, it turns out if you just... You can also heat and cool rock until it cracks.
Oh. <laughs> And then
you know, it's clearly much harder, but that's what they did.
That's why they have to fix our streets every year, because we heat and cool all of our cement very well here in Wisconsin.
Yes, but basically if you do it on purpose, you can start tunneling through rock.
Okay.
Yeah. So, yeah, that's what they did in China, to tunnel through the rock when they were making their irrigation system.
I think this is mentioned in a Ted Chiang short story.
Probably.
About the Tower of...
It's very famous.
The Tower of Babel.
it's very famous, yeah.
Yeah, we've cited more fantasy stories tonight than actual literature. But we'll put the, by actual literature, I mean scholarly literature. But we'll put all the citations to scholarly literature in the notes.
Yes, yes. Well, a lot of this, actually, it's funny, because, you know, these are mostly archaeological sites, which is where you get, you know, you get all this stuff. One of them, Machu Picchu, University of Wisconsin, interestingly, I didn't know this. Has a long history, you know, back however many decades, the 60s, 1950s, of being deeply involved with investigating the engineering of the Inca water management, I guess.
I know that we were involved with some potato farmers in that area to build more resistant potatoes. That could, like, grow in, you know, climate change related, but also, like, they are all at altitude and stuff.
Oh, wow. That's cool.
Yeah.
That is cool.
I know a woman who did a quilt commemorating this, so that's how I found out about it.
Well, there you go. Yes.
So that's super random. Well. But, yeah, Mae Madison.
Yeah. Well, so here's the site, actually, Madison. You know, we'll put it online, of course, but... Kenneth Wright and his wife, Ruth, both attended UW-Madison in the 1950s. Ken founded Wright Water Engineers in 1961. It grew into a Colorado water resource engineering company. Ruth is a public servant who advocates for natural resources policy, served in Colorado House of Representatives, instrumental in developing water quality standards after the U.S. Clean Water Act of 1972. They have spent years traveling to Peru and conducting research at Machu Picchu, and conducted research with a team of hydrologists, geologists, archaeologists, geographers, soil scientists, and employees from Wright Water Engineers, that's their company, also Peruvian archaeologists and community members, and spent 20 years preparing and seeking permits from the Peruvian government to be able to conduct research at Machu Picchu, study the way clean water was delivered through the city with springs, canals, and fountains, and have now shared the research. So they did a whole report and all this stuff.
Cool.
Yeah. So, yep, there you go. Madison. Ta-da! Who knew? It comes with nice diagrams and stuff.
Nice. Yes.
But, yeah. So, you know, that's what a lot of these are, of course. But yeah, so I guess then the final part of this, as I said, right, we've talked about how soap and things, you know, made you smell good. This was the point, of course, of toothpaste. It's still really the point of toothpaste. It's not just to clean your teeth, but to make your breath smell good. And so perfume, finally, right? This is the final thing. Like, after you've had your bath, you want to smell good. You perfume yourself. You perfume your clothes. Perfumes are also really, really old.
Okay.
This shouldn't be super surprising, but they are. And it's a well-known sort of adjective, you know, going as back however far you can go back with writing, that when things are described as sweet-smelling, right? So this is a really important concept, basically. The idea of things smelling good, which, of course... Yes, is a bit of a reminder that things didn't always.
Yes.
But again, that can be true today. So things smelling sweet. one of the places that people are probably most likely to have run into this, if you are a Westerner listening to this podcast, is descriptions of Aphrodite or Venus, but, you know, Greece is earlier, so Aphrodite for Greece, who is usually sweet-smelling. Her temples are sweet-smelling, and it's sort of a reminder of the extent to which also this is seen as seductive, right? So goddesses of love, like Ishtar as well, right, so go way back, tend to be described as sweet-smelling or to be involved in places that are sweet-smelling, right? So their temples are expected to be sweet-smelling. That is one of the attributes, right? And so there are some fun things like frescoes from Pompeii and Herculaneum that, of course, were destroyed in Vesuvius, so that's how they're still around, that show Cupids mixing perfumes. Yes, which is a reminder, cherubs, you know, Cupids. But it's a reminder of that connection, right? That just like today, you probably don't, you might not wear perfume all the time, but you might wear it if you're like going on a date or whatever. So, that type of thing. That's also when you take a really long shower, right? And make sure you're really clean. It's like when you're going out on the town. So same thing, right? Yeah. So that's what perfumes are for as well. It's also just a funny note. So smells, what we said that smell for a very long time, right? This goes way, way back, certainly to the Greeks, but, is the idea that a bad smell is like disease and sickness and good smells are healthy, which of course is where they didn't call it aromatherapy, but that's where that idea comes from.
Yeah.
Right? That if you're smelling something good, so that's where the Doctor of the Plague mask comes from, that giant beak nose.
Yes.
Right? Because the idea is you're keeping away and you'd put stuff in it.
Flowers and stuff. Right?
Yes. Yes. So that you get the sweet smell, so you're protecting yourself from disease, because the bad smell can't get to you.
Okay.
The funny thing, of course, is that it, as much as it works as a mask, it might be helpful, as we all know. Right?
Maybe.
It's not about the bad smell, it's just about
having a big leather thing between you and the disease, basically.
Yes. Yes. The water droplets of whoever coughed not being able to get on you. Yes. Exactly. So that sort of thing. Yeah. But it does become really important. And it's funny because other parts of Greek culture are based on this as well. So there's the famous thing like Prometheus tricks the gods into taking just the bones and the fat in a sacrifice, right? So Prometheus like butchers up a bull, I think, whatever he does. And he puts all the really good meat and like so the best cuts of meat and everything, and he like wraps them in leaves or something and puts them in a place, and then he puts the fat in the bones and surrounds them and, you know, lights it on fire so the fat is smoking. We all know what sizzling fat smells like. Right. It's a delicious smell, right? And he asks the gods what they want as a sacrifice. So the gods, of course, smell the great sizzling fat, and they're like, oh, that. And Prometheus is like, great. So from then on, whenever the Greeks had a sacrifice, right, you just the smoke wafted the smell of, like, the fat up to the gods, and then you got to eat the meat, which is why, of course, we have the word festival, because it's a feast, right? Because you got to have a feast, because you got all the meat, and the gods just got the bones and the fat.
Yeah.
Yeah, but it was the smell, yes. And but, of course, it was a trick, and the gods got pissed off at Prometheus. So it's funny, because it's actually a little bit of a reminder that maybe, you know, smell isn't always the thing you thought it was or whatever. But oils and perfumes are taken really seriously. So, famously, although there weren't shower bombs or bath bombs or anything back in the day, in ancient Egypt, they did have, like, cones. This is one of my favorite things about ancient Egypt since I was a kid.
Okay.
I just want to put it out there. Because it's just really, really interesting. So after you've, like, you know, had your bath or whatever, whatever, there was a cone that you sort of put on your head, like a party hat.
Okay.
You know? But you can also think, like, wearing your hair in a bun.
Mm-hmm.
You know? It's a sort of decoration you put on your head. Like a funky hat. And in it is basically perfume. It was in this case, it was always going to be a sort of thicker perfume, right? And it was a sort of like wax cone that would slowly drip the sort of perfumed oil into your hair over the course of the day.
Oh, okay.
Which is fascinating. It's amazing. It's genius. People today, of course, spend how much time, like, putting oils in their hair and whatever. Mm-hmm. This is great. You can go out about your day in the hot Egyptian sun, and it will just slowly melt and, like, drip the oil into your hair. What?
Nice.
Yeah. It's like...
Okay, so wait. Hmm? How big were these? Because I'm honestly picturing something like the size of a traffic cone, which is maybe
big. No. I was like, it's smaller than an actual birthday party hat.
Okay.
It's okay. Like an ice cream cone. It's an ice cream cone
Okay.
Like so normal, small ice cream cone size.
Something you could, like, wrap your hair around or something. Yeah.
Yes, that's exactly what it is. Yeah. Yeah. It's, like, not, like, giant waffle cone size. It's, like, you know.
Sugar cone size.
Yeah, small sugar cone size. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
But super cool. I love it. It's so brilliant. Also, so that's one way to do it, of course. More common, eventually, are... bottles, you know, and then you put it on yourself, as we do today, dab here, dab there, right? Bottles could be made from precious metals, all sorts of things. Eventually, glass is very old, it's worth pointing out. It's been around for a very long time, but knowledge of it kind of goes in and out. It doesn't become mass-produced, really, till the first century before the Common Era.
Okay.
When basically the Roman world figures out how to sort of mass produce glass. Mm-hmm. And that's when you start to get all these gorgeous glass jars that were usually used for perfume. Mm-hmm. And to this day, you know, beautiful cut glass jars are used for perfume. So that's sort of, that's it, right? For the past 2,000 years, that's how perfume has come.
Yeah.
But before that, when glass was not mass produced in the same way, there'd be other types of bottles, you know, enameled bottles, things. But, anyway, the fun thing about perfume is that also it really hasn't changed much.
Right.
You know, because it's an oil of some kind. Like, that's just what it is. Today, a lot of perfumes, the base is actually alcohol, so it sort of evaporates and leaves the smell behind. The thing about oils is that they evaporate much slower, so it would have been a much subtler smell, actually. So I think we also think of... We both think of the Middle Ages having really smelly in a bad way, but I think we also think of, like, when we read how perfumed people were, we assume that it was, like, this really cloying, like, when you go to a show and the person in front of you has way too much perfume on, you're like, oh my god, I can't breathe. No, right? It wasn't like that. I mean, it's not that it couldn't have been like that. You could bathe in it if you were rich enough, but generally speaking, because it's all oil-based and therefore does not sort of, you know, evaporate in the same way, it would have been a subtler smell. Mm-hmm. Right? So, it was more just, you know, once again, like, the world around you is pungent in various ways. You know, you're just helping out a little bit with a little bit of nice, sweet-smelling stuff. So, there have been attempts... Okay, the main ingredients are things that are basically still used today. Mm-hmm. So we'll go over those first. And then we'll say that people have attempted to recreate some of these, and they're a lot of fun. And they are actually very mild, which is how I know, because I've smelled some in museums that people have recreated.
Oh.
And they really are. They're very mild compared to any modern perfume, honestly. Like, unscented lotion is about as, you know, like, perfumed as some of this. Mm-hmm. Like... Which is weird to me, but unscented lotion still has a smell, kind of, you know? Or unscented soap, even, right? It has a clean smell.
Right.
Which is just psychological. Like, we think of that as clean, because you know it's soap. But, honestly, like, sort of ancient perfume is similar. It's this very sort of mild, you know, but you could be like, oh, I think that's some rose. Mm-hmm. But anyway, so... and obviously, so perfume, different from, like, incense, which, of course, again, is, you know, temples and stuff... But we're not talking about that. We're talking about, you know, perfume. What you would do, like, after you'd had a bath. Mm-hmm. So, basic ingredients, I guess. One of the things they found from Roman Egypt, there was a bottle. A jar. There was a jar that was found. There's sort of this region that was really well known. It had two of the most well-known perfumes of the ancient world were made in this town or at this site. And they found clearly a place, you know, based on the archaeological remains that had made one of these or maybe both of these perfumes. Mm-hmm. And so they sort of tested what was inside the jar.
Okay.
And the bases were myrrh, cardamom, olive oil, and cinnamon.
Okay.
Yes. And myrrh, frankincense. we might recognize
some of those. Yeah.
Yes. Were very, very common bases for perfumes. So perfumes are made by layering scents. So you have the base. That's like the smell that's underneath everything and the one that lasts the longest after the others have evaporated. Mm-hmm. And then you have like the middle notes and then the sort of top notes that just give it a little bit extra but disappear a little bit faster. And so that's sort of how you build your perfume. And frankincense and myrrh and labdanum, which is another resin. These are all resins or plant saps. Right.
Okay.
These are really, really common. I mean, these are the main things that show up in perfume, you know, around the world. Anyway, and of course, gold, frankincense, and myrrh, as we know, was brought to some baby somewhere. Yes. And it's they're symbolic also in that case, right? Mm-hmm. Frankincense is like the incense because of priesthood and myrrh, resurrection and kinghood and stuff and. Gold kinghood, but there's also, I mean, the point, like, these are things you would bring because they're sweet smelling, it would be for like good health. Mm-hmm. Right, and all this stuff, so it's not actually as weird as maybe people sometimes think it is today.
Sure.
Right, it's the same, it's like bringing flowers, but mm-hmm. you wouldn't bring flowers because they would die, but you're bringing the smell, which is what people want, really, out of the flowers, right? Okay, so which brings us to, of course, other notes on top of that. So those are usually the bases, mm-hmm. are saps, plant saps, but common sort of middle notes are, obviously, like flowers and stuff, but rose, cinnamon, styrix, is the ancient world, which is now known as benzoin. It's another plant, of course.
Okay.
Lavender, rosemary, sage, camphor, and mint.
Okay.
All show up. Yeah. So really, all things we use today, basically. And then top...
kind of almost, I don't know, kind of medicinal. I guess I associate some of those smells as...
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, a lot of them are supposed to be. That was actually sort of the thing.
Yeah.
Camphor. Yeah. And remember, because that's the point, like, a good smell keeps you healthy.
Right.
So it really is kind of aroma therapy. Yeah, that's what we think of, like, camphor or mint or sage mm-hmm. or rosemary. You're right. Yeah, all of them. But that is kind of the point, that you're keeping yourself healthy, right?
Yeah.
And then top notes would include things like anise, licorice, marjoram, oregano, coriander.
a lot of cooking herbs.
Yeah. Yes. Which isn't in some ways surprising, honestly, yeah, right? These are things that smell good.
I like it, but because, like, okay, so I feel like I have had a lot of perfumes that just smelled like you're getting punched in the face with roses.
Yes. So, right.
Like, oregano or basil sounds great.
Yes.
Basil perfume, sure.
Yeah, or smell a little of chamomile. Like, why not? Yeah, that'd be awesome. I know. It's not as common, somehow, for weirdly. In the Middle Ages, you get to the point where it really is also seen as kind of medicinal. I mean, it already is, but the Middle Ages comes up with pomander.
Okay.
Which comes from pom... I mean, it's French. It comes from the French for... Amber apple.
Okay.
Yeah. It's like pomed amber. Anyway, so an amber apple, which they meant amber, they didn't mean the sort of stone really. They meant it kind of as a smell. It's like a perfumed apple.
Mm-hmm.
And it was basically a hollow thing. It's like a thing that today we'd put tea in to infuse into water.
Oh, okay.
But instead, you put perfumes in it.
Okay.
And again, right, they're sort of thick, so they would just slowly seep through as you carried it around with you. And you can sort of waft it around yourself. If you felt like you were, you know, were you walking part past, like, the, you know, dung heap part of town or whatever, you'd kind of waft it in front of yourself quickly.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, and then, but otherwise you sort of carry it around, you know, it'd be, like, attached to your waist or something. You sort of have it with you. Kind of an early aromatherapy thing, right?
Keep bad smells away. It's almost sounds like a travel version of, gosh, like those stupid Glade plugins that people get
yes.
to their houses, or like those yep. air fresheners that you can hang from your rearview mirror.
Yes, it is 100% that. That yeah. is exactly what it is. We should give a shout out to Deadpool and the fact that the taxi driver has, does he have like daffodil something or other?
Yeah.
Hanging around, yes. Daffodil Daydream, right. Hanging around in his, yes. Yeah, that's exactly what it is. The word exists from... in English, again, OED, of course, thank you, from mid to late 1400s. Mm-hmm. So it's attested in English in the Middle Ages. Yeah, so this is a thing you can hear around. And you can definitely go online and find, like, fancy examples of these. But, yeah, so you'd carry it around with you as well. You know, maybe you didn't have time to take a bath, and therefore you'd carry it around. But yeah, so this is sort of a really important thing. It's also fun to remember that... you know, once perfume has become a thing, it's not just, I mean, if you are not a wealthy person, you can probably only afford, you know, to have it sometimes, like after a bath or before a special night. But if you are wealthy, you can perfume everything. You can perfume her clothes.
Yeah.
You can perfume everything, right? Cleopatra supposedly perfumed the sails of her ship to the point that, like, Mark Antony could smell it as it was coming down the Nile.
Oh, no.
Yeah. Which is brilliant.
Yeah. And like yep. it's like having entrance music, but in an olfactory yes. way. Like,
yes.
Ah, she's right. coming.
But it, yep. It adds to her mystique, of course, right? That yeah. is the point. Right? That the wind would like blow her scent ahead of her. Yeah. Which is awesome. Anyway.
I do know that when like modern eau de cologne was invented, which was at the beginning of the 1700s in mm-hmm. Cologne. It yeah. was almost immediately sold to royalty across Europe, especially yeah, yeah. like, uh-huh. you know, Louis XIV. So,
yeah, yeah, of course.
And one of the, there's one type of eau de cologne, which is called 4711. I don't know if that's how they call it. That's the street number where it was developed, but it's still being made 200 years later. You can still buy it.
Awesome.
So.
Yeah. Well, yeah. hopefully Chanel number 5 lasts that long.
Yeah. Yes.
Yay. Shout out, of course, to Coco Chanel. But yeah, right? There is something really impressive also about the fact that a lot of things haven't really changed when it comes to perfume, mm-hmm. which is funny.
Well, but there's a... in more... I mean, like, the upshot of the industrialization process, although I'm not sure, like, industrialization is the right word, but eventually... it becomes more simple to make it smell the same every batch, from, like, batch yes. to batch.
Yes.
Which is one of those weird things, like, you never think about, why does every, you know, jar of orange juice that you buy, or bottle of orange juice, why do the oranges always right. taste the same? If you right. buy Chanel No. 5 20 years ago, like, you go back in time and you buy it today, why does it smell the same?
Yep.
Science.
It's impressive.
Yeah.
Yes. Science is amazing.
Question mark.
But...
the but also idea. Interesting,
yeah. Cleopatra actually probably had her own, like royal perfume maker, I guess.
All right.
I
mean, that's so, also a way to get it to work, right? Like, just pay some yeah. guy to be super, super attentive.
Yeah, but it also meant, but that would mean like she had her own smell, presumably. That's the point, right? So that nobody else could have the same one she had. Right. Yeah. So the ones that were really, really famous from, you know, the region of Egypt,
were not hers.
That were kind of like the Chanel or whatever of the day, those would have been like sought after, mm-hmm. but not, you know, but if you were rich enough, you could pay to have your own. So you yeah. wouldn't sort of smell like everyone else who could afford perfume. You would, right. So Cleopatra, presumably only Cleopatra could smell like. Yeah. Cleopatra.
It's not even at this point, I don't want to smell like a peasant. It's like, I don't even want to smell like the nearest nobility. I want to be...
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah. like, fair enough. It's good to be the queen, right? So...
Right. I mean, and Cleopatra Lake, you know.
She was classy.
She will never be forgotten. Yeah. So good for her. Partly, you know, partly her, partly Shakespeare.
Yeah. Well, go big or go home.
And yes.
She did it. So.
Yep. Yeah. But it is, I want to give another shout out to the Ray Fiennes, Sofia Canedo, Antony Cleopatra. If you ever get a chance to watch it online or National Theater on demand or live or whatever they call it. It's amazing, amazing production.
Okay.
And a reminder of, again, why Cleopatra's amazing. She's amazing. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of recent attempts, I think, in performances to kind of demythologize her, mm-hmm. which is fine, sort of, except that it's not like there are enough women who are that mythologized to begin with.
Right.
So, yeah. Anyway. So, shout out to Shakespeare for keeping it going, I guess is what I'm saying.
As ever.
She does not, big yes, ups. She does not need to be taken down a peg. There aren't enough women up that far, yeah. I guess, is the point. Yep. But yeah, anyway, so famously, her perfumed sails and...
Alright.
Yep. Yay!
Okay. So, shall we leave it there? I think that's yes. a good top note to end on. Ha ha ha.
Yay.
Yes. Well, thank you.
Perfume jokes!
Oh, no. I'm just gonna nose my way on out of this one. Okay. Thank you for talking to me, and thank you everyone for listening. If you enjoyed our podcast, you can follow us on your podcast app. Hopefully you already did that. You can find us on the web at askamedievalist.com. You can tell your friends about us if you see them. You know, I don't see people, but I assume some of you do. And Facebook, Ask a Medievalist, just search for us. Whatever. Just keep Googling until you see the snail and the guy logo. You know what you're doing. I think that's about it. So until next time, wash your hands and then apply perfume liberally if you want to and keep it medieval.
Ask a Medievalist is a production of This Can't Be That Hard Studios and is not endorsed, acknowledged, or condoned by Virginia Commonwealth University or any of its constituent departments. Our theme music is Veni Veni Venias from Carmina Burana by Carl Orff, performed by the MIT Concert Choir and licensed under a Creative Commons Attributional Non-Commercial License version 3.0. If you enjoyed our podcast, please rate us and leave a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. Also, why not tell a friend? For more on today's topic, including sources, annotations, and corrections, visit our website at www.askamedievalist.com. And if you have questions, feel free to drop us an email at questions@askamedievalist.com.